come to live except on its own terms. Those terms contradict yours. What are its terms? The High Lord asked carefully. That your world is a dream. In the startled stillness of the close, Covenant grimaced, winced as images flashed at him. Courthouse columns, an old beggar, the muzzle of the police car. A dream, he panted feverishly. A dream? None of this is happening. Then Osandria shot out, What? A dream? Do you mean to say that you are dreaming? Do you believe that you are asleep? Yes. He felt weak with fear. His revelation bereft him of a shield, exposed him to attack. But he could not recant it. He needed it to regain some kind of honesty. Yes. Indeed, she snapped. No doubt that explains the slaughter of the celebration. Tell me, unbeliever, do you consider that a nightmare, or does your world relish such dreams? Before Covenant could retort, Lord Morham said, Enough, Sister Osandria. He torments himself sufficiently. Glaring, she fell silent, and after a moment, Prothol said, It may be that gods have such dreams as this. But we are mortals. We can only resist ill or surrender. Either way, we perish. Were you sent to mock us for this? Mock you? Covenant could not find the words to respond. He chopped dumbly at the thought with his half hand. It's the other way around. He's mocking me. When all the lords looked at him in incomprehension, he cried abruptly, I can feel the pulse in my fingertips. But that's impossible. I've got a disease. An incurable disease. I've got to figure out a way to keep from going crazy. Hell and blood. I don't want to lose my mind just because some perfectly decent character in a dream needs something from me that I can't produce.
Well, that may be.
Prothol's voice held a note of sadness and sympathy, as if he were listening to some abrogation or repudiation of sanity from a revered seer.
But we will trust you nonetheless. You are bitter, and bitterness is a sign of concern. I trust that. And what you say also meets the old prophecy. I fear the time is coming when you will be the land's last hope.
Don't you understand? Covenant groaned, unable to silence the ache in his voice. That's what Fowl wants you to think.
Perhaps, Morham said thoughtfully. Perhaps.
Then, as if he had reached a decision, he turned the peril of his gaze straight at Covenant.
Unbeliever, I must ask you if you have resisted Lord Fowl. I do not speak of the celebration. When he bore you from Druel Rockworm to Kevin's Watch, did you oppose him?
The question made Covenant feel abruptly frail, as if he had snapped a cord of his resistance.
I didn't know how.
Wearily, he reseated himself in the loneliness of his chair.
I didn't know what was happening. You are Ur-Lord now, murmured Morham. There is no more need for you to sit there.
No need to sit at all, amended Prothol, with sudden briskness.
There is much work to be done. We must think and probe and plan. Whatever action we will take in this trial must be chosen quickly. We will meet again tonight. Tuvor, Garth, Birinair, Torm. Prepare yourselves and those in your command. Bring whatever thoughts of strategy you have to the council tonight, and tell all the keep that Thomas Covenant has been named Urlord. He is a stranger and a guest. Birinair, begin your work for the giants at once. Bannor, I think the Urlord need no longer stay in the tower. He paused and looked about him, giving everyone a chance to speak. Then he turned and left the close. Ossandria followed him, and after giving Covenant another formal salute, Morum also departed. Numbly, Covenant moved behind Bannor up through the high passages and stairways until they reached his new quarters. The Blood Guard ushered him into a suite of rooms. They were high-ceilinged, lit by reflected sunlight through several broad windows, abundantly supplied with food and spring wine, and unadorned. When Bannor had left, Covenant looked out one of the windows and found that his rooms were perched in the north wall of Revelstone, with a view of the rough plains and the northward curving cliff of the plateau. The sun was overhead, but a bit south of the keep, so that the windows were in shadow. He left the window, moved to the tray of food, and ate a light meal. Then he poured out a flask of spring wine, which he carried into the bedroom. There he found one oriled window. It had an air of privacy, of peace. Where did he go from here? He did not need to be self-wise or prophetic to know that he could not remain in Revelstone. He was too vulnerable here. He sat down in the stone alcove to brood over the land below and wonder what he had done to himself. Chapter 15. The Great Challenge. That night, when Bannor entered the suite to call Thomas Covenant to the evening meeting of the Lords, he found Covenant still sitting within the oriel of his bedroom window. By the light of Banner's torch, Covenant appeared gaunt and spectral, as if half seen through shadows. The sockets of his eyes were dark with exhausted emotion. His lips were gray, bloodless, and the skin of his forehead had an ashen undertone. He held his arms across his chest as if he were trying to comfort a pain in his heart, watched the plains as if he were waiting for moonrise. Then he noticed the Blood Guard, and his lips pulled back, bared his teeth. "You still don't trust me," he said in a spent voice. Bannor shrugged. "We are the Blood Guard. We have no use for white gold." "No use? It is a knowledge, a weapon. We have no use for weapons." "No use," Covenant repeated dully. "How do you defend the Lords without weapons?" "We..." Bannor paused as if searching the language of the land for a word to match his thought. "Suffice." Covenant brooded for a moment, then swung himself out of the oriel. Standing in front of Bannor, he said softly, "Bravo." Then he picked up his staff and left the rooms. This time he paid more attention to the route Bannor chose and did not lose his sense of direction. Eventually, he might be able to dispense with Banner's guidance. When they reached the huge wooden doors of the close, they met Foam Follower and Korik. The giant greeted Covenant with a salute and a broad grin, but when he spoke, his voice was serious.
"Stone and sea, Urlord Covenant. I am glad you did not choose to make me wrong. Perhaps I do not comprehend all your dilemma, but I believe you have taken the better risk for the sake of all the land."
"You're a fine one to talk," replied Covenant wanly. His sarcasm was a defensive reflex. He had lost so much other armor. "How long have you giants been lost? I don't think you would know a good risk if it kicked you." Foam Follower chuckled.
"Bravely said, my friend. It may be that the giants are not good advisors, all our years notwithstanding. Still, you have lightened my fear for the land. grimacing uselessly, Covenant went on into the close. The council chamber was as brightly lit and acoustically perfect as before, but the number of people in it had changed. Tamarantha and Varial were absent, and scattered through the gallery were a number of spectators. Radamarl, Lilianral, warriors, lore wardens. Bloodguard sat behind Morum and Osandria, and Tuvor, Garth, Birinair, and Torm were in their places behind the High Lord. Foam Follower took his former seat, gesturing Covenant into a chair near him at the Lord's table. Behind them, Banner and Korix sat down in the lower tier of the gallery. The spectators fell silent almost at once. Even the rustle of their clothing grew still. Shortly, everyone was waiting for the High Lord to begin. Prothol sat, as if wandering in thought for some time before he climbed tiredly to his feet. He held himself up by leaning on his staff, and when he spoke, his voice rattled agedly in his chest. But he went without omission through the ceremonies of honoring Foam Follower and Covenant. The giant responded with a gaiety which disguised the effort he made to be concise, but Covenant rejected the formality with a scowl and a shake of his head. When he was done, Prothol said, without meeting the eyes of his fellow lords, "There is a custom among the new lords, a custom which began in the days of High Lord Valant 100 years ago. It is this. When a High Lord doubts his ability to meet the needs of the land, he may come to the council and surrender his High Lordship. Then any lord who so chooses may claim the place for himself." With an effort, Prothol continued firmly, "I now surrender my leadership. Rock and root, the trial of these times is too great for me. Urlord Thomas Covenant, you are permitted to claim the High Lordship if you wish." Covenant held Prothol's eyes, trying to measure the High Lord's intentions, but he could find no duplicity in Prothol's offer. Softly, he replied, "You know I don't want it. Yet I ask you to accept it. You bear the white gold." "Forget it," Covenant said. "It isn't that easy." After a moment, Prothol nodded slowly.
"I see."
He turned to the other lords.
"Do you claim the High Lordship?"
"You are the High Lord," Morum averred,
and Osandria added, "Who else? Do not waste more time in foolishness."
"Very well."
Prothol squared his shoulders.
"The trial and the doom of this time are on my head. I am High Lord Prothol, and by the consent of the council, my will prevails. Let none fear to follow me, or blame another if my choices fail."
An involuntary twitch passed across Covenant's face, but he said nothing, and shortly Prothol sat down, saying, "Now let us consider what we must do." In silence, the lords communed mentally with each other. Then Osandria turned to Foam Follower.
"Rock Brother, it is said, when many matters press you, consider friendship first. For the sake of your people, you should return to Sea Reach as swiftly as may be. The giants must be told all that has transpired here. But I judge that the waterway of Andalane will no longer be safe for you. We will provide an escort to accompany you through Grimmerdor Forest and the North Plains until you are past Landsdrop and Serengrave Flat."
"Thank you, my lords," replied Foam Follower formally, "but that will not be needed. I have given some thought myself to this matter. In their wandering, my people learned a saying from the Brother: he who waits for the sword to fall upon his neck will surely lose his head. I believe that the best service which I can do for my people is to assist whatever course you undertake. Please permit me to join you." High Lord Prothol smiled and bowed his head in acknowledgement.
My heart hoped for this. Be welcome in our trial. Peril or plight, the giants of Sea Reach strengthen us, and we cannot sing our gratitude enough. But your people must not be left unwarned. We will send other messengers. Foam Follower bowed in turn, and then Lord Osandria resumed by calling on Warmark Garth. Garth stood and reported, Lord, I have done as you requested. Furl's fire now burns atop Revelstone. All who see it will warn their folk and will spread the warning of war south and east and north. By morning, all who live north of the Soul's Ease and west of Grimmerdor will be forearmed, and those who live near the river will send runners into the center plains. Beyond that, the warning will carry more slowly. I have sent scouts in relays toward Grimmerdor and Andalain, but 6 days will pass before we receive clear word of the forest. And though you did not request it, I have begun preparations for a siege. In all, 1,300 of my warriors are now at work. 20 yeomen remain ready. That is well, said Osandria. The warning which must be taken to Sea Reach, we entrust to you. Send as many warriors as you deem necessary to ensure the embassy. Garth bowed and sat down. Now, she nodded her head as if to clear it of other considerations. I have given my time to the study of Ur-Lord Covenant's tale of his journey. The presence of white gold explains much, but still many things require thought. South-running storms, a three-winged bird, an abominable attack on the wraiths of Andalain, the bloodying of the moon. To my mind, the meaning of these signs is clear. Abruptly, she slapped the table with her palm as if she needed the sound and the pain to help her speak. Drool Rockworm has already found his bane. The Ill-Earth's stone or some other deadly evil. With the Staff of Law, he has might enough to blast the seasons in their course. A low groan arose from the gallery, but Prothol and Morum did not appear surprised. Still, a dangerous glitter intensified in Morim's eyes as he said softly, Please explain. The evidence of power is unmistakable. We know that Drool has the Staff of Law. But the staff is not a neutral tool. It was carved from the one tree as a servant of the earth and the earth's law. Yet all that has occurred is unnatural, wrong. Can you conceive the strength of will which would corrupt the staff even enough to warp one bird? Well, perhaps madness gives Drool that will, or perhaps the despiser now controls the staff. But consider, birthing a three-winged bird is the smallest of these ill feats. At his peak in the former age, Lord Fowl did not dare attack the wraiths. And as for the desecrated moon, only the darkest and most terrible of ancient prophecies bespeak such matters. Do you call this proof conclusive that Lord Fowl indeed possesses the staff? But consider, for less exertion than corrupting the moon requires, he could surely stamp us into death. We could not fight such might, and yet he spends himself so vainly. Would he employ his strength to so little purpose, against the wraiths first when he could easily destroy us? And if he would, could he corrupt the moon using the Staff of Law, a tool not made for his hand, resisting his mastery at every touch? I judge that if Lord Fowl controlled the staff, he would not and perhaps could not do what has been done. Not until we were destroyed. But if Drool still holds the staff, then it alone does not suffice. No cave white is large enough to perform such crimes without the power of both staff and stone. The cave whites are weak-willed creatures, as you know. They are easily swayed, easily enslaved, and they have no heaven-challenging lore. Therefore, they have always been the fodder of Lord Fowl's armies. If I judge truly, then the despiser himself is as much at Drool's mercy as we are. The doom of this time rides on the mad whim of a cave-wight. This I conclude, because we have not been attacked. Prothol nodded glumly to Osandria, and Morum took up the line of her reasoning. So Lord Fowl relies upon us to save him and damn ourselves. In some way he intends that our response to Ur-Lord Covenant's message will spring upon ourselves a trap which holds both us and him. He has pretended friendship to Drool to preserve himself until his plans are ripe. And he has taught Drool to use this newfound power in ways which will satisfy the Cave White's lust for mastery without threatening us directly. Thus he attempts to ensure that we will make trial to wrest the Staff of Law from Drool. And therefore, Osandria barked, it would be the utterest folly for us to make trial. How so? Morum objected. The message said, without it they will not be able to resist me for 7 years. He foretells a sooner end for us if we do not make the attempt, or if we attempt and fail than if we succeed. What does he gain by such foretellings? What but our immediate deaths? His message is only a lure of false hope to lead us into folly. But Morum replied by quoting, Drool Rockworm has the staff, and that is a cause for terror. He will be enthroned at Lord's Keep in 2 years if the message fails. The message has not failed, Osandria insisted. We are forewarned. We can prepare. Drool is mad, and his attacks will be flawed by madness. It may be that we will find his weakness and prevail. By the Seven, Revelstone will never fall while the Blood Guard remain, and the Giants and Ronahin will come to our aid. Turning toward the High Lord, she urged, Prothol, do not follow the lure of this quest. It is Chimera. We will fall under the shadow, and the land will surely die. But if we succeed, Morum countered, if we gain the staff, then our chance is prolonged. Lord Fowl's prophecy notwithstanding, we may find enough earth power in the staff to prevail in war. And if we do not, still we will have that much more time to search for other salvations. How can we succeed? Drool has both the Staff of Law and the Illyrith Stone, and is master of neither. Master enough! Ask the wraiths the extent of his might. Ask the moon. Ask me, growled Covenant, climbing slowly to his feet. For a moment he hesitated, torn between a fear of Drool and a dread of what would happen to him if the lords did not go in search of the staff. He had a vivid apprehension of the malice behind Drool's Laval eyes. But the thought of the staff decided him. He felt that he had gained an insight into the logic of his dream. The staff had brought him to the land. He would need the staff to escape. Ask me, he said again. Don't you think I have a stake in this? The lords did not respond, and Covenant was forced to carry the argument forward himself. In his brooding, he had been able to find only one frail hope. With an effort, he broached the subject. According to you, Fowl chose me. But he talked about me on Kevin's watch as if I had been chosen by someone else. My enemy, he said. Who was he talking about? Thoughtfully, the High Lord replied, I do not know. We said earlier that we hoped there were other forces at work in your selection. Perhaps there were. A few of our oldest legends speak of a creator, the creator of the earth. But we know nothing of such a being. We only know that we are mortal, but Lord Fowl is not. In some way he surpasses flesh. The creator, Covenant muttered. All right. A disturbing memory of the old beggar who had accosted him outside the courthouse flared momentarily. Why did he choose me? Prothol's abnegate eyes did not waver.
Who can say?
Perhaps for the very reasons that Lord Foul chooses you. That paradox angered Covenant, but he went on as if inspired by the contradiction. Then this creator also wanted you to hear Foul's message. Take that into account.
There,
Ausandria pounced. There is the lie I sought, the final bait. By raising the hope of unknown help, Lord Foul seeks to ensure that we will accept this mad quest. Covenant did not look away from the High Lord. He held Prothol's eyes, tried to see beyond the wear of long asceticisms into his mind. But Prothol returned the gaze unflinchingly. The lines at the corners of his eyes seemed etched there by self-abrogation. Lord Ausandria, he said evenly, does your study reveal any signs of hope?
Signs?
Omens? Her voice sounded reluctant in the close. I am not Morum. If I were, I would ask Covenant what dreams he has had in the land. But I prefer practical hopes. I see but one. So little time has been lost. It is in my heart that no other combination of chance and choice could have brought Covenant here so swiftly.
Very well, Prothol replied. His look, locked with Covenant's, sharpened momentarily, and in it Covenant at last saw that the High Lord had already made his decision.
He only listened to the debate to give himself one last chance to find an alternative. Awkwardly, Covenant dropped his eyes, slumped in his chair. How does he do it? He murmured pointlessly to himself. Where does all this courage come from? Am I the only coward? A moment later, the High Lord pulled his blue robe about him and rose to his feet.
My friends, he said, his voice thick with rheum, the time has come for decision. I must choose a course to meet our need. If any have thoughts which must be uttered, speak now.
No one spoke, and Prothol seemed to draw dignity and stature from the silence.
Hear then the will of Prothol, son of Dwillian, High Lord by the choice of the council. And may the land forgive me if I mistake or fail. In this moment I commit the future of the earth. Lord Ausandria, to you and to the Lords Varial and Tamarantha I entrust the defenses of the land. I charge you, do all which wisdom or vision suggest to preserve the life in our sworn care. Remember that there is always hope while Revelstone stands. But if Revelstone falls, then all the ages and works of the Lords, from Beric Hartthew to our generation, shall come to an end, and the land will never know the like again. Lord Morum and I will go in search of Druel Rockworm and the Staff of Law. With us will go the giant Saltheart Foam Follower, Ur-Lord Thomas Covenant, as many of the Bloodguard as First Mark Tuvor deems proper to spare from the defense of Revelstone, and one Yeoman of the Warword. Thus we will not go blithe or unguarded into doom, but the main might of Lord's Keep will be left for the defense of the land if we fail. Here. And be ready. The quest departs at first light.
High Lord, protested Garth, leaping to his feet. Will you not wait for some word from my scouts? You must brave Grimmerdor to pass toward Mount Thunder. If the forest is infested by the servants of Druul or the Greyslayer, you will have little safety until my scouts have found out the movements of the enemy.
That is true, Warmark, said Prothol. But how long will we be delayed?
6 days, High Lord. Then we will know how much force the crossing of Grimmerdor requires.
For some time, Morum had been sitting with his chin in his hands, staring absently into the graveling pit. But now he roused himself and said, 100 Bloodguard, or every warrior that Revelstone can provide.
I have seen it. There are Urvils in Grimmerdor, and wolves by the thousands. They hunt in my dreams.
His voice seemed to chill the air in the close like a wind of loss. But Prothol spoke at once, resisting the spell of Morhem's words.
No, Garth, we cannot delay,
and the peril of Grimmerdor is too great. Even Druul Rockworm must understand that our best road to Mount Thunder leads through the forest and along the north of Andalane.
No, we will go south,
around Andalane, then east through Morhen Mas to the plains of Ra, before moving north to Graven Threndor.
I know, that seems a long way, full of needless leagues, for a quest which must rue the loss of each day. But this southward way will enable us to gain the help of the Ramen. Thus, all the Despiser's olden foes will share in our quest, and perhaps we will throw Druul out of his reckoning.
No, my choice is clear. The quest will depart tomorrow, riding south. That is my word. Let any who doubt speak now. And Thomas Covenant, who doubted everything, felt Prothol's resolution and dignity so strongly that he said nothing. Then Morhem and Osandria stood, followed immediately by Foamfollower, and behind them the assembly rushed to its feet. All turned toward High Lord Prothol, and Osandria lifted up her voice to say,
Melancurian Skyweir watch over you, High Lord. Melancurian Abatha, preserve and prevail. Seed and rock may your purpose flourish. Let no evil blind or ill assail, no fear or faint, no rest or joy or pain assuage the grief of wrong. Cowardice is inexculpate, corruption unassoiled. Skyweir watch and earthroot anneal. Melancurian Abatha, Minus Mil Cabal.
Prothol bowed his head, and the gallery and the lords responded with one unanimous salute, one extending of arms in mute benediction. Then in slow order the people began to leave the close. At the same time, Prothol, Morhem, and Osandria departed through their private doors. Once the lords were gone, Foamfollower joined Covenant, and they moved together up the steps, followed by Banner and Korik. Outside the close, Foamfollower hesitated, considering something, then said,
My friend, will you answer a question for me?
You think I've got something left to hide?
As to that, who knows? The fairy Elohim had a saying, The heart cherishes secrets not worth the telling. Ah, they were a laughing people. But,
no, Covenant cut in. I've been scrutinized enough. He started away toward his rooms.
But you have not heard my question.
He turned. Why should I? You were going to ask what Atiyaran had against me.
No, my friend, replied Foamfollower, laughing softly. Let your heart cherish that secret to the end of time. My question is this. What dreams have you had since you came to the land? What did you dream that night in my boat?
Impulsively, Covenant answered, A crowd of my people, real people, were spitting blood at me. And one of them said there is only one good answer to death.
Only one? What answer is that?
Turn your back on it, Covenant snapped as he strode away down the corridor. Outcast it. Foamfollower's good-natured humor echoed in his ears, but he marched on until he could no longer hear the giant. Then he tried to remember the way to his rooms. With some help from Banner, he found the suite and shut himself in, only bothering to light one torch before closing the door on the Bloodguard. He found that in his absence someone had shuttered his windows against the fell light of the moon. Perversely, he yanked one of them open, but the bloodscape hurt his eyes like the stink of a corpse, and he slammed the shutter closed again. Then for a long time before he went to bed, he paced the floor, arguing with himself until fatigue overcame him. When morning neared and Banner began shaking him awake, he resisted. He wanted to go on sleeping as if in slumber he could find absolution. Dimly, he remembered that he was about to start on a journey far more dangerous than the one he had just completed, and his tired consciousness moaned in protest. "Come," said Banner. "If we delay, we will miss the call of the run-in." "Go to hell," Covenant mumbled. "Don't you ever sleep." "The Blood Guard do not sleep." "What?" "No Blood Guard has slept since the Haruchai swore their vow." With an effort, Covenant pulled himself into a sitting position. He peered blearily at Banner for a moment, then muttered, "You're already in hell." The alien flatness of Banner's voice did not waver as he replied, "You have no reason to mock us." "Of course not," Covenant growled, climbing out of bed. "Naturally, I'm supposed to enjoy having my integrity judged by someone who doesn't even need sleep." "We do not judge. We are cautious. The Lords are in our care." "Like Kevin, who killed himself and took just about everything else with him." But as he made this retort, he felt suddenly ashamed of himself. In the firelight, he remembered the costliness of the Blood Guard's fidelity. Wincing at the coldness of the stone floor, he said, "Forget it. I talk like that in self-defense. Ridicule seems to be my only answer." Then he hurried away to wash, shave, and get dressed. After a quick meal, he made sure of his knife and staff, and at last nodded his readiness to the Blood Guard. Banner led him down to the courtyard of the old Gildan tree. A haze of night still dimmed the air, but the stars were gone, and sunrise was clearly imminent. Unexpectedly, he felt that he was taking part in something larger than himself. The sensation was an odd one, and he tried to reason it away as he followed Banner through the tunnel between the huge, knuckled tower gates and out into the dawn. There, near the wall a short distance to the right of the gate, was gathered the company of the quest. The warriors of the Third Yeoman sat astride their horses in a semicircle behind Warhaft Quan, and their left stood 9 Blood Guard led by First Mark Tuvor. Within the semicircle were Prothol, Morum, and Saltheart Foam Follower. The giant carried in his belt a quarterstaff as tall as a man, and wore a blue neck scarf that fluttered ebulliently in the morning breeze. Nearby were 3 men holding 3 horses saddled in Klingor. Above them all, the face of Revelstone was crowded with people. The dwellers of the mountain city thronged every balcony and terrace, every window. And facing the gathered company was Lord Osandria. She held her head high as if she defied her responsibility to make her stoop. Then the sun crested the eastern horizon. It caught the upper rim of the plateau, where burned the blue flame of warning. It moved down the wall until it lifted High Lord's Furl out of the gloaming like the lighting of a torch. Next, it revealed the red pennant and then a new white flag. Nodding up at the new flag, Banner said, "That is for you, Ur-Lord, the sign of white gold." Then he went to take his place among the Blood Guard. Silence rested on the company until the sunlight touched the ground, casting its gold glow over the questers. As soon as the light reached her feet, Osandria began speaking as if she had been waiting impatiently for this moment, and she covered the ache in her heart with a scolding tone. "I am in no mood for the ceremony, Prothol. Call the run-in and go. The folly of this undertaking will not be made less by delay and brave words. There is nothing more for you to say. I am well suited for my task, and the defense of the land will not falter while I live. Go. Call the run-in." Prothol smiled gently, and Morum said with a grin, We are fortunate in you, Osandria. I could not entrust any other with Vario, my father, and Tamarantha, my mother.
Taunt me at your peril, she snapped. I am in no mood. No mood, do you hear?
I hear. You know that I do not taunt you. Sister Osandria, be careful.
I am always careful. Now go, before I lose patience altogether.
Prothol nodded to Tuvor. The 10 blood guard turned and spread out so that each faced into the rising sun with no one to obscure his view. One at a time, each blood guard raised a hand to his mouth and gave a piercing whistle which echoed off the wall of the keep into the dawn air. They whistled again, and then a third time, and each call sounded as fierce and lonely as a heart cry. But the last whistle was answered by a distant whinny and a low thunder of mighty hooves. All eyes turned expectantly eastward, squinted into the morning glory. For a long moment, nothing appeared, and the rumble of the earth came disembodied to the company, a mystic manifestation. But then the horses could be seen within the sun's orb, as if they had materialized in skyfire. Soon the Ranahin passed out of the direct line of the sun. There were 10 of them, wild and challenging animals. They were great craggy beasts, deep-chested, proud-necked, with some of the delicacy of pure-blooded stock and some of the rough angularity of mustangs. They had long flying manes and tails, gaits as straight as plumb lines, eyes full of restless intelligence. Chestnuts, bays, roans that galloped toward the blood guard. Covenant knew enough about horses to see that the Ranahin were as individual as people, but they shared one trait. A white star marked the center of each forehead. As they approached, with the dawn burning on their backs, they looked like the land personified, the essence of health and power. Nickering and tossing their heads, they halted before the blood guard, and the blood guard bowed deeply to them. The Ranahin stamped their feet and shook their manes as if they were laughing affectionately at a mere human show of respect. After a moment, Tuvor spoke to them. Hail, Ranahin, land riders and proud bearers, sun, flesh, and sky mane, we are glad that you have heard our call. We must go on a long journey of many days. Will you bear us? In response, a few of the horses nodded their heads, and several others pranced in circles like colts. Then they moved forward, each approaching a specific blood guard and nuzzling him as if urging him to mount. This the blood guard did, though the horses were without saddle or bridle. Riding bareback, the blood guard trotted the Ranahin in a circle around the company and arrayed themselves beside the mounted warriors. Covenant felt that the departure of the company was imminent, and he did not want to miss his chance. Stepping close to Osandria, he asked, "What does it mean? Where did they come from?" The lord turned and answered almost eagerly, as if glad for any distraction, "Of course, you are a stranger. Now how can I explain such a deep matter briefly? Consider, the Ranahin are free, untamed, and their home is in the plains of Ra. They are tended by the Ramen, but they are never ridden unless they choose a rider for themselves. It is a free choice, and once a Ranahin selects a rider, it is faithful to that one, though fire and death interdict. Few are chosen. Tamarantha is the only living lord to be blessed with a Ranahin mount. Hynerel bears her proudly, though neither Prothol nor Morum have yet made the trial. Prothol has been unwilling. But I suspect that one of his reasons for journeying south is to give Morum a chance to be chosen. No matter. Since the age of High Lord Kevin, a bond has grown up between the Ranahin and the Bloodguard. For many reasons, only some of which I can guess, no Bloodguard has remained unchosen. As to the coming here of the Ranahin today, that surpasses my explaining. They are creatures of earth power. In some way, each Ranahin knows when its rider will call. Yes, knows, and never fails to answer. Here are Hurin, Braba, Marni, and others. 10 days ago, they heard the call which only reached our ears this morning. And after more than 400 leagues, they arrive as fresh as the dawn. If we could match them, the land would not be in such peril. As she had been speaking, Prothol and Moram had mounted their horses, and she finished while walking Covenant toward his Mustang. Under the influence of her voice, he went up to the animal without hesitation. But when he put his foot in the stirrup of the Klingor's saddle, he felt a spasm of reluctance. He did not like horses, did not trust them. Their strength was too dangerous. He backed away and found that his hands were trembling. Osandria regarded him curiously. But before she could say anything, a bustle of surprise ran through the company. When he looked up, Covenant saw 3 old figures riding forward, the lords Varial and Tamarantha, and Heartthrall Birinair. Tamarantha sat astride a great roan Ranahin mare with laughing eyes. Bowing toward them from the back of his horse, High Lord Prothol said, "I am glad that you have come. We need your blessing before we depart, just as Osandria needs your help." Tamarantha bowed in return, but there was a sly half-smile on her wrinkled lips. She scanned the company briefly. "You have chosen well, Prothol." Then she brought her old eyes back to the High Lord. "But you mistake us. We go with you." Prothol began to object, but Birinair put in stoutly, "Of course. What else? A quest without a higher brand, indeed." "Birinair," said Prothol reprovingly, "surely our work for the Sea Reach Giants requires you." "Requires? Of course. As to that, why," the higher brand huffed, "as to that, no. Shames me to say it. I have given all the orders. No. The others are abler, have been for years." "Prothol," Tamarantha urged, "do not forbid. We are old. Of course we are old. And the way will be long and hard. But this is the great challenge of our time. The only high and bold enterprise in which we will ever be able to share." "Is the defense of Revelstone then such a little thing?" Varial jerked up his head as if Prothol's question had been a jibe. "Revelstone remembers we have failed to retrieve any of Kevin's lore. What possible help can we be here? Osandria is more than enough. Without this quest, our lives will be wasted." "No, my lords, no. Not wasted," Prothol murmured. With a baffled expression, he looked to Moram for support. Smiling crookedly, Moram said, "Life is well designed. Men and women grow old so that someone will be wise enough to teach the young. Let them come." After another moment's hesitation, Prothol decided. "Come, then. You will teach us all." Varial smiled up at Tamarantha, and she returned his gaze from the high back of the Ranahin. Their faces were full of satisfaction and calm expectancy, which they shared in the silent marriage of their eyes. Watching them, Covenant abruptly snatched up his horse's reins and climbed into the saddle. His heart thudded anxiously, but almost at once the Klingor gave him a feeling of security which eased his trepidation. Following the example of Prothol and Moram, he slid the staff under his left thigh, where it was held by the Klingor. Then he gripped the Mustang with his knees and tried not to fret. The man who had been holding the horse touched Covenant's knee to get his attention. "Her name is Dura, Dura Fairflank. Horses are rare in the land. I have trained her well. She is as good as a Ranahin," he boasted, then lowered his eyes as if embarrassed by his exaggeration. Covenant replied gruffly, I don't want to run in. The man took this as approval of Dura and beamed with pleasure. As he moved away, he touched his palms to his forehead and spread his arms wide in salute. From his new vantage, Covenant surveyed the company. There were no pack horses, but attached to every saddle were bags of provisions and tools, and Birinair had a thick bundle of Lilianril rods behind him. The Blood Guard were unencumbered, but Foam Follower carried his huge sack over his shoulder and looked ready to travel as fast as any horse. Shortly, Prothol rose in his stirrups and called out over the company, "My friends, we must depart. The quest is urgent and the time of our trial presses upon us. I will not try to stir your hearts with long words or bind you with awesome oaths, but I give you two charges. Be true to the limit of your strength, and remember the oath of peace. We go into danger, and perhaps into war. We will fight if need be, but the land will not be served by angry bloodshed. Remember the code. Do not hurt where holding is enough. Do not wound where hurting is enough. Do not maim where wounding is enough. And kill not where maiming is enough. The greatest warrior is one who does not need to kill." Then the High Lord wheeled his mount to face Revelstone. He drew out his staff, swung it three times about his head, and raised it to the sky. From its end, a blue incandescent flame burst, and he cried to the keep, "Hail, Revelstone!" The entire population of the keep responded with one mighty, heart-shaking shout, "Hail!" That myriad-throated paean sprang across the hills. The dawn air itself seemed to vibrate with praise and salutation. Several of the Ranahin nickered joyously. In answer, Covenant clenched his teeth against a sudden thickening in his throat. He felt unworthy. Then Prothol turned his horse and urged it into a canter down the hillside. Swiftly, the company swung into place around him. Morum guided Covenant to a position behind Prothol, ahead of Varial and Tamarantha. Four Blood Guard flanked the lords on either side. Quan, Tuvor, and Korik rode ahead of Prothol, and behind came Birinair and the Yeoman. With a long, loping stride, Foam Follower pulled abreast of Morum and Covenant, where he jogged as easily as if such traveling were natural to him. Thus, the quest for the Staff of Law left Lord's Keep in the sunlight of a new day. Chapter 16. Bloodborne. Thomas Covenant spent the next 3 days in one long, acute discovery of saddle soreness. Sitting on thin leather, he felt as if he were riding bareback. The hard physical fact of Dura's spine threatened to saw him open. His knees felt as if they were being twisted out of joint. His thighs and calves ached and quivered with the strain of gripping his mount, a pain which slowly spread into and up his back, and his neck throbbed from the lash of Dura's sudden lurchings as she crossed the obstacles of the terrain. At times he remained on her back only because the Klingor saddle did not let him fall. And at night his clenched muscles hurt so badly that he could not sleep without the benefit of Diamond Draught. As a result, he noticed little of the passing countryside, or the weather, or the mood of the company. He ignored or rebuffed every effort to draw him into conversation. He was consumed by the painful sensation of being broken in half. Once again, he was forced to recognize the suicidal nature of this dream, of what the subconscious darkness of his mind was doing to him. But the giant's diamond draught and the land's impossible health worked in him regardless of his suffering. His flesh grew tougher to meet the demands of Dura's back, and without knowing it, he had been improving as a rider. He was learning how to move with instead of resisting his mount. When he woke up after the third night, he found that physical hurting no longer dominated him. By that time, the company had left behind the cultivated region around Revelstone and had moved out into rough plains. They had camped in the middle of a rude flatland, and when Covenant began to look about him, the terrain that met his eyes was rocky and unpromising. Nevertheless, the sense of moving forward reasserted itself in him, gave him once again the illusion of safety. Like so many other things, Revelstone was behind him. When Foam Follower addressed him, he was able to respond without violence. At that, the giant remarked to Morum, "Stone and sea, my lord. I believe that Thomas Covenant has chosen to rejoin the living. Surely this is the work of Diamond Rod. Hail, Ur-Lord Covenant. Welcome to our company. Do you know, Lord Morum, there is an ancient giantish tale about a war which was halted by Diamond Rod? Would you like to hear? I can tell it in half a day." "Indeed," Morum chuckled. "And will it take only half a day if you tell it on the run while we ride?" Foam Follower laughed broadly. "Then I can be done by sunset tomorrow. I, Saltheart Foam Follower, say it."
"I have heard that tale," High Lord Prothol said. "But the teller assured me that Diamond Rod did not in fact end the conflict. The actual reign was giantish talk. When the giants were done asking after the causes of the war, the combatants had been listening so long that they had forgotten the answer." "Ha ha, High Lord," Foam Follower chortled, "you misunderstand. It was the giants who drank the Diamond Rod."
Laughter burst from the listening warriors, and Prothol smiled as he turned to mount his horse. Soon the quest was on its way, and Covenant fell into place beside Morum. Now as he rode, Covenant listened to the traveling noises of the company. The lords and Bloodguard were almost entirely silent, preoccupied. But over the thud of hooves, he could hear talk and snatches of song from the warriors. In Quan's leadership, they sounded confident and occasionally eager, as if they looked forward to putting their years of sword training to the test. Some time later, Lord Morum surprised Covenant by saying, without preamble, "Ur-Lord, as you know, there were questions which the Council did not ask of you. May I ask them now? I should like to know more concerning your world."
"My world?"
Covenant swallowed roughly. He did not want to talk about it. He had no desire to repeat the ordeal of the Council.
"Why?"
Morum shrugged.
"Because the more I know of you, the better I will know what to expect from you in times of peril. Or because an understanding of your world may teach me to treat you rightly. Or because I have asked the question in simple friendship."
Covenant could hear the candor in Morum's voice, and it disarmed his refusals. He owed the lords and himself some kind of honesty, but that debt was bitter to him, and he could not find any easy way to articulate all the things which needed saying. Instinctively, he began to make a list.
"We have cancer, heart failure, tuberculosis, multiple sclerosis, birth defects, leprosy. We have alcoholism, venereal disease, drug addiction, rape, robbery, murder, child beating, genocide." But he could not bear to utter a catalogue of woes that might run on forever. After a moment, he stood in his stirrups and gestured out over the ruggedness of the plains. "You probably see it better than I do. But even I can tell that this is beautiful. It's alive. It's alive the way it should be alive. This kind of grass is yellow and stiff and thin, but I can see that it's healthy. It belongs here, in this kind of soil. By hell, I can even see what time of year this is by looking at the dirt. I can see spring. Where I come from, we don't see. If you don't know the annual cycles of the plants, you can't tell the difference between spring and summer. If you don't have a standard of comparison, you can't recognize. But the world is beautiful. What's left of it? What we haven't damaged?"
Images of Haven Farm sprang irrefusably across his mind. He could not restrain the mordancy of his tone as he concluded, "We have beauty too. We call it scenery."
"Scenery," Morum echoed. "The word is strange to me, but I do not like the sound."
Covenant felt oddly shaken, as if he had just looked over his shoulder and found himself standing too close to a precipice. "It means that beauty is something extra," he rasped. "It's nice, but we can live without it."
"Without?"
Morum's gaze glittered dangerously, and behind him Foam Follower breathed in astonishment.
"Live without beauty? Ah, my friend, how do you resist despair?"
"I don't think we do," Covenant muttered. "Some of us are just stubborn." Then he fell silent. Morum asked him no more questions, and he rode on chewing the gristle of his thoughts until High Lord Prothol called a rest halt. As the day progressed, Covenant's silence seemed slowly to infect the company. The traveling banter and singing of the yeomen faded gradually into stillness. Morum watched Covenant curiously askance, but made no effort to renew their conversation, and Prothol looked as night-faced as the Bloodguard. After a time, Covenant guessed the cause of their reticence. Tonight would be the first full of the bloody moon. A shiver ran through him. That night would be a kind of test of Drool's power. If the Cave White could maintain his red hold even when the moon was full, then the lords would have to admit that his might had no discernible limit. And such might would be spawning armies, would almost certainly have already produced marauders to feed Drool's taste for pillage. Then the company would have to fight for passage. Covenant remembered with a shudder his brief meeting with Drool in the cavern of Kirill Threndor. Like his companions, he fell under the pall of what the night might reveal. Only Varyal and Tamarantha seemed untouched by the common mood. She appeared half asleep and rode casually, trusting the Ranahin to keep her on its back. Her husband sat erect, with a steady hand on his reins, but his mouth was slack and his eyes unfocused. They looked frail. Covenant felt that he could see the brittleness of their bones. But they alone of all the company were blithe against the coming night, blithe or uncomprehending. The riders camped before dusk on the north side of a rough hill, partially sheltered from the prevailing southwest breeze. The air had turned cold like a revisitation of winter, and the wind carried a chill to the hearts of the travelers. In silence, some of the warriors fed and rubbed down the horses, while others cooked a spare meal over a fire that Birinair coaxed from one of his Lilianril rods and some scrubwood. The Ranahin galloped away together to spend the night in some secret play or rite, leaving the horses hobbled and the blood guard standing sentinel, and the rest of the company huddled in their cloaks around the fire. As the last of the sunlight scudded from the air, the breeze stiffened into a steady wind. Covenant found himself wishing for some of the camaraderie that had begun the day, but he could not supply the lack himself. He had to wait until High Lord Prothol rose to meet the apprehension of the quest. Planting his staff firmly, he began to sing the Vespers hymn of Revelstone. Morum joined him, followed by Varyal and Tamarantha, and soon the whole yeoman was on its feet, adding its many-throated voice to the song. There they stood under the stern sky, 25 souls singing like witnesses. 7 hells for failed faith, for land's betrayers, man and wraith, and 1 brave lord to deal the doom to keep the blacking blight from beauty's bloom. They raised their voices bravely, and their melody was counterpointed by the tenor roll of Foam Follower's plainsong. When they were done, they reseated themselves and began to talk together in low voices, as if the hymn were all they needed to restore their courage. Covenant sat staring at his knotted hands. Without taking his eyes off them, he knew when moonrise came. He felt the sudden stiffening around him as the first crimson glow appeared on the horizon. But he gnawed on his lip and did not look up. His companions breathed tensely, A red cast slowly deepened in the heart of the fire, but he clenched his gaze as if he were studying the way his knuckles whitened. Then he heard Lord Moran.